Well, folks, it's initial night because I'm JR. My guest is MVP, and that's okay by me. So, hey, man, how you doing?
Man, I'm doing exceptionally well. Good to hear from you. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for being on the show. I've been wanting to talk to you because, you know, ever since I met you and I found out about your background, it was really one of the most compelling stories that I had ever heard. And the fact that what you've gone through, and a lot of people may not know the whole story, but that we're going to talk about here tonight, is amazing to me. So I know you grew up in Florida, right? And you're a Florida guy.
Yeah, Miami, all the way down to the bottom of the map.
And your dad was a policeman?
Yes, he was. Yeah.
As a defiant young lad growing up in Miami, how was it being the son of a cop?
It was interesting because he was around in my life, but he wasn't an everyday force. I lived with my mother, with both of my brothers. And, you know, he was, best way to categorize it, you know, a part-time dad. I had his telephone number. We would talk. You know, he'd come by. We'd hang out sometimes. But by the time I became a teenager, I didn't have that constant male role model in the house. My father figure, it got to a point where when I saw my father, it usually meant that I was in trouble. Mm-hmm. So when the big stuff happened, my mom would say, "Go call your father," or she'd, "Hey, your son did this," and you know, he was generally cool about a lot of it. And he looking in hindsight, yeah, he could have tried a lot harder. But you know, whenever I was there in trouble for the big stuff, I mean, he came through. You know, he came to court and he helped me out. And, you know,
do you think that not having that father figure kind of led you a little bit more easily into gang life?
Absolutely, yeah. Because you just, you know, my mom did her best to be a mother and a father, but, you know, no matter how hard you try, you just can't do it all. And she relied on me to be mature beyond my years, to help her with my younger brothers and, you know, cooking around the house and things of that nature. So I matured a lot quicker than most kids. And, you know, when I was 13, 14, I was hanging with people that were 17 and 18. Mm-hmm. And I was into the things that they were into. And if I had had, you know, a consistent father figure in the house, I think there just would have been another authority figure to answer to. And I wouldn't have been able to spend so much time doing things that I shouldn't have been doing. And, you know, I would imagine that if I had a father figure, then maybe there would have been more emphasis on sports, as you know, an extracurricular activity that would have taken up my time and not allowed me to go down those paths.
You know, that's a good, a real good synopsis for fathers that are listening to this show. If you're going to make a kid, you know, you got to be there, and you need to be there. And even if you're divorcing the mom, that's no excuse not to be in the kid's life, in the son's life, or the daughter's life. It's an important thing. Now, your situation became escalated to the point that you went to prison for 8.5 years, right?
9.5.
Nine and a half. Oh God. Well, 8.5, 9. Still, it's all a long time. 9.5 years. What were you convicted of?
I was convicted of 1 count of armed robbery, 10 counts of armed kidnapping.
Wow.
And that's in the state of Florida. If you hold someone against their will to facilitate a robbery, legally they consider that kidnapping. So in my case, the people that were in the casino that we robbed, we locked them in a closet, and then we exited. So because there were 10 people that we locked in a closet in the state of Florida, that's armed kidnapping, each one of those punishable by life in prison.
Wow. That is...
So in 2016, I was in the county jail with no bond, facing 11 life felonies.
At what age?
16.
16 years old. A 16-year-old kid is old enough to get his driver's license, and here you are in a county jail looking at potentially 11 life sentences. What was your total sentence at the end of the day? What was your sentence that they gave you?
Well, what ended up happening after sitting in the county jail for the better part of a year, you know, letting the legal wheels turn as slowly as they do, we negotiated a plea agreement where I would plead guilty in exchange for 18 and a half years with a mandatory 3 years for the sawed-off shotgun that was used in the robbery. So I had a total of 18 and a half years with a mandatory 3, which means for the first 3 years of my sentence, I couldn't earn any time off for good behavior. Of that, I served 9.5.
When you were in prison, were you already a wrestling fan, or did that? I mean, I don't know. Where did your love of the business? Where did you embrace the business? Was it because, you know, I'm looking at a kid here that's 12 or 13 running with 17 and 18 year old guys. I don't know if you're a fan then. Then you get in trouble at 16, and now you're going away for 9.5. Where the hell did you fit that in at?
You know, JR, it's amazing how it all comes together. And that's why I believe that my professional wrestling career was actually my destiny. And the reason I say that is because as a child, my mom, her worked at the Miami Beach Convention Center. So the first time I ever saw wrestling, I saw it live because we used to get in through the side door and sit up in the stands. And I remember watching these behemoths just pummel each other and my mom and all these adults around me screaming and cheering and booing. And I just remember this was amazing to me. I think couldn't have been more than 4 years old. And, you know, it became a routine every time wrestling came to town. If we were able, my mom would take me to the Miami Beach Convention Center, and I saw Dusty Rhodes and I saw Terry Funk, and, you know, at a young age. So that seed was planted then. And over the years, like most kids growing up in Miami, we watched Gordon Solie. Yep. And, you know, we used to get lots of syndicated wrestling. So we got World Class. We got AWA. We got Georgia Championship. We got everything because it just came in. It was, you know, cheap programming for Channel 33 and Channel 39. So I grew up watching wrestling, and I always enjoyed it. When I got in trouble the first time as a teenager, and I did 6.5 months in a juvenile facility, while I was there, there was a wrestler by the name of Rozier, and he used to work as Death Row. He worked at the juvenile detention center. For career day, he brought in Soul Man Alex G, who was part of the Soul Patrol with Global Wrestling. And that's the first time I met Soul Man Alex G. And while the other guys, they were clowning, I was asking Alex G, you know, shoot questions. I wanted, you know, hey, how does this, how do you do this? How does that work? And, you know, Alex was protecting the business back then. So that was the first time that I had actually met a professional wrestler. Fast forward all these years later, I'm at work release, about to get out of prison, and one of the officers there was an indie worker, and he would bring in videotapes of indie matches and put them in for us to watch before we usually had about 10 or 15 minutes before we were allowed to be let out to go to work in the morning at the work release center. So we kill that time by watching wrestling. And one day I see Soul Man Alex G, and I say, Officer Davis, that guy's Alex G. I met him when I was in Utah about 10 years ago. And he said, yeah, man, we wrestled together. That officer, Officer Davis, he worked on the Indies in South Florida as primetime Daryl D. He offered to train me when I got out if I was interested, because I would always go to him and ask him, hey, man, how do you guys do suplexes without breaking each other's neck? And I was curious. I wanted to know. And he made the offer. And I knew I was getting out of prison. I needed a hobby, something to do to keep me out of trouble. And a few months after I got out, he invited me over, started training in his yard. And after about 2 or 3 lessons, he had to take the ring down he had set up in his sister's backyard. He brought me to Duke the Dumpster Drozzi's wrestling school, and the head instructor was Soul Man Alex G. And there I was.
Fake, man. You couldn't get away from it because, I mean, you're going from the 4 or 5 years old at the convention center there in Miami Beach, which is, you know, a legendary place. I know that at one time that thing was so hot, red hot, and Dusty was hot, and the Florida territory was just bursting with amazing skill, talent. But Dusty electrified that territory when he turned babyface. He was amazing, and they got that Miami Beach Convention Center with Chris Dundee, Angelo Dundee, who's a trainer of Muhammad Ali. His brother was a promoter in Miami for Eddie Graham. So yeah. It's pretty cool. You're not getting away from Alex G. Alex G. then had a big part, obviously, goes without saying, in forming you or creating this wrestling body of work. You know,
Alex G. was the one that taught me my ABCs and my 1-2-3s. He was the one that I'll never forget. One day at training, Alex told everybody, he said, okay. Because prior to him taking over the school, there was another teacher whose name I don't recall, but you know, he obviously wasn't a very good one. Alex was trained by the Malenkos. So he was trained by the great Malenkos, yeah. Dean and Joe. Those were the guys who trained him. That's his pedigree.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, if I'm taking over the school and I'm being a teacher, this is going to be run like a real wrestling school now. So there's no more playing around. Those of you who really want to do this will be here. And he said, look next to you, because a lot of these guys won't be here next week. And in less than a month, the attendance of the school had dwindled to about 25% of what it was. Once you guys quit, when it got serious.
Yeah.
You know, to this day, I always say, you know, I remember Alex would, certain guys, when he would run us through drills, a guy would take a real crappy bump, you know, or just do something real bad, and Alex would go, okay, good job, keep going. But there were certain guys, like myself being one of them, that he wouldn't accept anything. No, do it again. You didn't jump high enough. Hey, do it again. You didn't go fast enough. Hey, do it again. You didn't get low enough. And I was like, man, how come he's always picking on me? It didn't dawn on me until afterwards. All the guys that he picked on were the guys that were left.
He thought you guys had something. He saw potential.
He knew, yeah. He knew who was going to be around and who wasn't.
When you were incarcerated those 9.5 years, did they allow you to work out? Were you able to get in they have a gym there or... Because, you know, you watch these crazy-ass documentaries, you know, like on cable where it's like a lockdown San Quentin or lockdown whatever. And you see these, a lot of these guys are jacked up, man. So you're thinking, well, they're not getting any gas. They're not getting any, they're not using any roids. they're behind bars, I guess, unless I'm being naive. So I'm thinking somebody's lifting some iron. Somebody's lifting weights or doing something. So were you able to build your body up while you were? Because that was a very formative time for a young, you know, young guy like you. That was a time, age-wise, that was a very pivotal time to grow and get stronger.
Absolutely, it was. I mean, I was one of those kids that in my neighborhood. I had a concrete weight bench on the porch. You know, it was, that's in my neighborhood. Everybody had one. Everybody used to bench press at the very least. Did curls, you know.
Yeah.
But because I went in at 16, 17. I remember one day going to the laundry, and I had suddenly decided, hey, I'm going to start hitting the weights hard. And, you know, my body just grew. You know, I gained 20 pounds in a few weeks and just was eating everything I could get in the chow hall and, you know, a little extra money for the commissary and training real hard. So my body was ready to grow. And I went to the laundry and asked the sergeant if I could get some new shirts. Because I grew about 3 sizes. And at the time, it didn't really make that big of a deal to me. But then looking back, you know, I remember the sergeant said, you know, to the one of the other officers, well, here's another one, baby growing into a man. And you know, I just kind of chuckled it off at the time. But, you know, as an adult looking back, you know, it was unfortunately even now generations of young teenagers with serious crimes literally becoming men in prison.
Yeah, yes, it's just so unfortunate in society, and it's a huge issue, man. I mean, we're gonna get into some better, more positive things, but you know, the positiveness of this is that you came out of that thing. I would think that getting bigger and stronger also in the general population behind the bars were allowed you to have a better chance of making people leave you alone. I mean, because if people want to pick out the weak out of the herd and exploit the weak, and a guy that's getting jacked up and strong and lifting weights, you might think twice. I mean, I'm just, that'd be my assumption. And I'm
you know, people, the guys that are into stuff, they always take the path of least resistance. And, you know, if you know, they think you'll fight, you're the last person they're going to want to bother. And, you know, you got to figure that's the world you live in. You live in a world where violence is the way many things are solved. It's just the nature of the beast. So, you know, it would behoove you to go hit the weights, to work out and play a little basketball, go jog and do some calisthenics to keep yourself up. Because you never know when you're going to have to fight at any given time. Some dude might want to try you, or some dude might be plotting to take something from you. When it goes down, you got to be able to handle yourself. You know, it just makes sense in terms of survival.
Yeah, it's the law of the jungle, man. It's the law of the jungle. Strong survive, and God bless the weak ones, because we know where they're going. They're on the 1 foot from extinction, you know, literally. And it's just amazing. Well, how was it getting booked once you were trained? Because here's the deal: no matter what we say, And it's still that way a little bit today. And maybe in your position, you may say, well, no, JR, it's that way a lot today. I don't know. I'm not putting words in your mouth yay or nay. But when you got trained, you had two issues going against you. One, you're a black man. Two, you were a convict. You just got out of prison. So now, how hard was it to get booked? How did you find work as a wrestler?
Well, in the beginning, the fact that I was a
ex-convict
yeah. never affected my bookings in any way, except until I got to WWE and was, you know, traveling internationally. That's
sure.
the only time it ever became an issue. As far as on the indie circuit, you know, it didn't really matter. Nobody cared. As far as being black goes, that is a whole other conversation.
Yeah.
I was very fortunate. And it was weird because the dynamic where I came up in Miami, you know, you had the black wrestlers and the white wrestlers. And a lot of the time in Miami, a lot of the black wrestlers weren't necessarily on all the white wrestler shows. So there was a little bit of animosity. And then, you know, it would work the other way around. The black guys would get together and they would book a show. And there wouldn't be that many white guys on. But then they would always, you know, bicker about how they don't use us and we don't use them. And, you know, fortunately I was able to get above that because I started working up in Tampa and I started getting work in Orlando and I was able to travel outside of my home base where everybody was, you know, getting into the petty rivalries that happened in indie wrestling. And that happened just because certain guys who were veterans that had been around saw something in me and said, hey, kid, you know, you might have a shot at doing something here. Let me get you booked somewhere else. So I wasn't, you know, I worked the indies and I was all over Florida, but I wasn't really making any money. I was still one of those broke wrestlers that had to, you know, bounce yep. at nightclub to, you know, feed my wrestling habit.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until I finally got a shot to go work for Savio Vega's promotion, IWA, in Puerto Rico. When Dutch and Luke were over there, that was the first time that I got to be a professional wrestler where I was making a living from wrestling.
Dutch Mantel, now known as Zeb Coulter, and Dutch and Savio, good guy. Dutch smart, good. That was a big break because you got to work regularly. You got to work with people better than you more often than not. Luke was a sharp guy. I thought it was always fun guy to be around when he was in the Mid-South territory as a sheep herder. A lot of people remember them as a comic act in WWE as the Bushwhackers, but they were serious ass team, man. Him and Luke Miller were outstanding, or Butch Miller were outstanding as a tag team, and violent and barbaric. I mean, they were bloodthirsty dudes, man. They were absolutely 180 from what they were in WWF at the time. So how old were you at that point?
I think when I got my breakdown in Puerto Rico, I was 28, I believe. 28, 29.
Yeah.
I broke into the business when I was 26. I went to prison when I was 16, and I came home when I was 26. So it was 27, I think, when I actually started training.
Wow.
Yes, by the time I got to Puerto Rico, I was probably about 27, 28, 29, probably right around 28, 29.
How long were you in Puerto Rico? Because it seemed like you were not much older than that when WWE hired you.
Yeah, I was down in Puerto Rico for about 4 months, and then I came back, and I think I was back about a year before I finally got an opportunity to get signed with WWE. A year, maybe two. I think when I got signed with WWE, I think I was 30 or 31.
Did we send you to, what was it, Deep South?
Yeah, I went down to Deep South.
Atlanta?
Absolutely.
With Jody Hamilton?
I was down there with Jody Hamilton and Bill DeMott. That's where I got my start. I reported to, I remember, here's a good story. John Laurinaitis was the one that I had pitched the MVP character to.
Mm-hmm.
And Ricky Santana, who's a good friend of John Laurinaitis, who I met while I was down in Puerto Rico, was a friend and mentor to me. I had told him, hey, man, you know, Rick, you know, put a word into John, man. You know, you got Carly a job, man. Help me out. You know, I'm trying to do something. And Rick said, hey, just be patient, man. Be patient. So when I came up with the MVP character, and I told Ricky about it, I said, look, man, I want to pitch this to the office, but I'm scared they'll steal it from me. And Ricky said, all right, well, let me talk to John, and, you know, one-on-one, man-to-man, and I promise. So that's how I met John, and, you know, that's, he told me to send in the idea for MVP. One day I come down to my car, I left my phone in my car, and I see my missed call log full of Ricky Santana calls. Immediately I called him, Ricky, what's up, man, what's going on? He said, man, kid, you want the bad news or you want the worst news? And I'm like, oh, man, what's going on, Rick? And he said, well, here's the bad news. The bad news is, and he knew how much I loved Japan. Japan was a place I've always wanted to work, and we'll get into that. But he told me at that moment, he said, listen, they just I just got off the phone with New Japan. They were looking for a guy to come in and work on top with Chono. They wanted a young, good-looking black guy. And, man, I had you lined up, but I had to hear back from you by 3 o'clock. It's 3:30. They went with some guy from California.
Oh.
I'm crushed. I'm absolutely devastated. And he said, you want to hear the worst news? I'm like, man, Rick, you know, kick a man when he's down. He said, I just heard from John Laurinaitis, and they don't want you at OVW, man. At this moment, my world has just collapsed. I'm thinking, man, the only two places left that I want to work, that I can make a living and have a career, Japan and WWE. You know, at the time, I wasn't really thinking about Mexico, but you know, this just happened, and I'm crushed. And Rick said, well, don't you at least want to know why they don't want you at OVW? Yeah, sure, Rick, why? Because they want you to report to Atlanta. Call Johnny East right now. He's going to give you a job.
Cool.
You son of a bitch.
Ricky and John had a good relationship, and I don't know, what year was that?
Wow, what was it? 05.
Oh, wow, okay.
Signed in 05 and debuted in 06.
So you came up with the MVP concept. They liked the concept. It fit your character. You know, here, I've always said this, and I think back in the territory days, one of the reasons the territory days were able to perpetuate themselves and work in these same facilities, these venues, week after week, like you talked about the Miami Convention Center, is that the booker would always get input from the talent on how to keep their program going and their storyline fresh and hot and what to add and little curves. But it was always with the console, more often than not, of the top guys. So the top guys always had a hand in their creative. Because, you know, Bill Watts told me one time, if the guys come up with an idea and the booker can mold it to where they still think it's their idea and it's going to help the company and the territory, then the talent feels a ownership, and they're going to work harder because they own part of that idea. So I want to talk about Impact, because I'm for Impact being successful, even though I have been, you know, critical of the creative from time to time, and we'll get into that later. But the issue is that character, I thought when you came in, you went to SmackDown, and I was doing Raw then. So I think you went to SmackDown, if I'm not mistaken. Didn't you come in and go, because what, Michael Hayes writing SmackDown at that time?
Yes, he was.
I remember one night, you and me and Michael were sitting at, and people said, oh, okay, here comes a bar story. It verifies everything anybody thought about JR and Hayes drinking. But we were sitting at a bar at the hotel at the Marriott in Pittsburgh the night before a big show. And, you know, that's my wife's hometown. So, I mean, everybody was well-behaved and nobody was drunk. It's just sitting there having a beer. But we got into a really cool conversation about your life and stuff we talked about, you coming down the other side and making yourself whole, which I think is cool. But I just thought that character, I was a little bit miffed that it wasn't on Raw, because I was thinking, man, I can describe this guy. I like this. But they got it on SmackDown, and it worked out. And I thought you had a good run on SmackDown. Would you say your SmackDown was better for you than Raw was as at the end of the day? Wouldn't you think? Or am I wrong?
No, you're absolutely right. It was, you know, SmackDown is where I cut my teeth. And it was where I had my most success. And while I was on SmackDown, you know, initially I was working with Kane and Undertaker every night. Me and Ken Anderson, with Mr. Kennedy, were tag teaming up against Kane and Undertaker every night all over the world for months. So, you know, we got a crash course in you know, how to work on top.
Sure.
Working with legends. And then after that, you know, I came out of that feud into my feud with Benoit. Mm-hmm. Again, you know, they're working with one of the greatest of all time. Every night, 30 minutes a night, because he went and asked for permission. Hey, can I take this kid 30 minutes every night? And had a hell of a run with him on TV. And then Matt Hardy, many people would say that he and I carried SmackDown in 07 with, you know, Taker being hurt and Ray being hurt and Dave having to work with Great Khali. You know, we had the most compelling and interesting storyline going on. Once I got to Raw, it seemed like the brakes were put on.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, you know, it was almost like, hey, man, the ride's over. So by far and away, SmackDown was my most successful time.
Yeah, that was the creative. You know, we can look back. It's easy for me now that I'm not in the business to look at creative in a different set of eyes. But it was, you know, a missed opportunity in my view when you came over to Raw, because it should have been a bigger impact. It should have been more impactful. You know, when you go 30 minutes a night with Benoit, he was like a buzzsaw. You know, he was had amazing pace and great instincts. And he really, him working with you, I thought, was probably, along with working with The Undertaker and Kane, goodness gracious, you're going to college, man. You're getting a PhD with these guys. When,
yeah.
Well, how did you, you know, I get this mentioned in the break. I get this all the time. You know, why isn't Chris Benoit in the Hall of Fame? Or do you think Chris Benoit will go into the Hall of Fame? And I say, no, I don't think he will. I don't think he'd want to, because I think if he knows if he went in, it would be a distraction. And I may be wrong, but that's my opinion. That's all. And because people wouldn't remember him, the greatness that he was in the ring. They wouldn't remember his days as a Pegasus kid in New Japan. They wouldn't remember his, idolizing Tommy Billington, the Dynamite Kid. They remember him as a murderer, and that's damn sad. That's society. What do you think about the Hall of Fame thing? I'll ask you that question.
I never considered it from Chris's point of view, as you just did. That's the first time that I had even thought about it in those terms. And it's funny, on Twitter, I deal with this all the time. You know, fans are selfish. They don't care about your life. They care about them. Hey, what are you coming back on our TV? What are you going to do this for us? So as fans of Chris Benoit's work, you know, I guess we didn't take the time to think, well, wait, hold on a second. What would Chris say? And you're the first person that really brought that to my attention. And the Chris Benoit that I knew, he would say that he didn't deserve to be. If he was in a position to be conscious of his actions, he would be in an eternity of torment. And, you know, I got to be very, very close with Chris in our time together. We rode together. He took a personal interest in me and mentored me, and I got to know the side of him that few people do. And I can say at this point, after you pointing it out, I don't think Chris would feel that he deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. And that's my opinion.
Yeah. Here's the deal. He was a consummate team guy. Back in the days, I was head of talent relations when we brought him in with Perry Saturn and Malenko Dean, and then Chris split off on his own, and then he had the neck injury, and I remember talking to him, and he wanted to go. We had the option of doing two different kinds of surgeries. They could do the one from behind, in the back of the neck, and he would be good for a shorter length of time. Or they could go through and be out of action for a short length of time, but it wouldn't be the fix that he needed long term. But he would be out shorter. And so if you go through the front, he's going to be out probably a year. But the neck's going to be solid, but he's going to be out a year. So we sat down, I remember sitting down at a TV in Atlanta and discussing what we were going to do. And so I said, okay, you know, you've heard the doctor, and the doctor's worked on some other people, and he's good, Dr. Youngblood in San Antonio, best there is.
Right.
We're going to get you the best doctor that's, you know, he fixed Stone Cold. So, and we looked, and he's looking off in space, and he says, what do you think I should do? I said, well, I think you should do the one that takes a year to get over, because it'll be fixed. You know, and for your afterlife, after you're bumping, you're going to be okay. And, well, what about my contract? What about your contract? We're going to pay you your weekly salary while you're healing. and no interruption. I said, I will tell you that contractually, the contracts where we could let you go was if you were inactive because of medical reasons after 6 weeks or six, I think it was 6 or 8 weeks, you could be terminated. But I never did. That's cold-hearted as hell. The company's not going to do that. So, and you'd be stupid to do it psychologically in the locker room with a guy like him, even if he had no soul, you know. So he stood up, and I stood up, and he said, I'm going to do what you suggest. And he grabbed me. And I didn't know if he was going to belly-to-belly suplex my fat ass or what he was going to do, man. I was going to go for a ride. But he hugged me. It popped my vertebrae. I mean, he hugged me like it was amazing, and almost had a tap. But he was so relieved that we had made a decision. And then at that moment, he felt good about it. I said, when you come back, man, people are going to want to see you. You know, the anticipation, you'll be healthy, you'll be fine, and you'll get all this time to spend that son of yours that you love so much and see your other kids that live in Edmonton. So there's some good out of this deal. So let's get you fixed. You'll stay getting paid, and you can spend – it'll be nice family time that you've never had since you've been in the business, a whole year to be a dad and a husband. And so all of a sudden, man, he's standing up and squeezing life out of me. So that's the side of Chris Benoit that a lot of people never saw, but he was a very sensitive guy by and large. And there's going to be some that are going to hear this and say, how can you sit there on your podcast, you bastard, and say that a guy is sensitive that murders his own family and takes his own life? Well, I don't know that guy that did that was the guy that I'm talking about right now.
That's my point. And I've talked about this publicly, and, you know, and I maintain the human psyche is so fragile. We don't really understand how it works, but we do know and we do understand that every day people snap.
Yep.
We can't explain why, but somebody who seems like everything's fine just snaps and goes on a shooting spree, or, you know, we even call it going postal, because it used to happen so often with postal workers. People mentally snap and they do things uncharacteristic of themselves. Chris didn't say, huh, you know what? I think I'm going to kill my wife and kid today because I want to be a fiendish bastard. That's not what happened. The man that I knew, the man that you knew, there's not a single person that has anything negative to say about Chris Benoit, the human being, prior to this incident. There was no warning, no indication that this something like this was even remotely possible. He snapped. He killed his wife, he killed his child, and then he took his own life. Sane people don't do that.
Yeah.
That's not something a person in their right frame of mind does. So I'm not making an excuse for him. I'm saying in our society, when things like this happen, we immediately attack this behavior, because it is horrific, but it's something happened mentally. And people who suffer from mental illness or have mental episodes are scared to talk about them, are scared to come out because of the ridicule that they receive from society. People are scared to be labeled as crazy. And, you know, in hindsight, the time that I spent with Chris had very deep emotional issues. And you know, he opened up to me about a lot of things. We bonded over my brother, his ex-wife, used to use their child to hurt him. My brother would plan trips. His ex-wife would say, okay, you can go. Then my brother would go to pick his son up, and she'd say, no, I changed my mind. You can't go. Silly things like that. And this would rip my brother's guts out. Well, apparently, you know, Chris had issues with his children that lived in Canada and his ex-wife, and we kind of bonded over that. And this, you know, this compassionate, loving human being that I knew that would cry talking about his kids, people have never seen this guy. They just know about the monster that the news reports have given them to consume. I'm not saying at any stretch of the imagination that Chris should be forgiven for what he did. I'm just saying that we should take time to try to understand why these things happen, why people do this, what happens in the mind that people snap and cause these violent acts. Now we're seeing all these random shootings, and almost invariably, a lot of these people are taking antidepressants. Is it a coincidence that a lot of these people that are suddenly feeling suicidal and homicidal are taking antidepressants? I don't know, but we should look into it. Obviously, there's something going on with people in their minds and drugs that are causing them to behave violently,
right,
taking other lives in their own.
No, well, that's good. You're a great description of the Benoit situation. You know, I'm not, you know, we both reluctantly agree that, you know, we not reluctantly in this fact that he was one of the best ever in the ring, best ever, one of the best I ever saw. And he defied, you know, logic of the small man, you know, getting over and all that stuff. Daniel Bryan's done the same thing. And other guys are, you know, they're not the first guys under 6 feet tall to draw money and work on top. But I think that, you know, Chris, it was a different human being that day. That was fateful last few hours of his life. But I still don't think he's a Hall of Fame guy. And as I said, I think if we had communication with him right now, wherever he is, he would agree with us that it would be a distraction, and that's not what he wants. Because I think wherever he is now, I don't get religious here, but I there's got to be something along what you said. There's that concussion thing, you know, all the concussions, you know, because he wasn't a drug guy. I mean, he never had drug and alcohol issues that I'm aware of.
You know what? That is actually an issue. Chris used to party hard. Chris liked to party. And his WCW days, he used a lot of ecstasy.
Really?
Yeah, lots of it.
Wow.
It's no secret that he used to party hard on that stuff. So if you take into consideration, and, you know, again, like I said, I'm not trying to make excuses. I'm just trying to understand. If you take into consideration all the brain damage from the multiple concussions, and you take into consideration what ecstasy does to your brain, and you're doing it, you know, nightly from what I understand, along, you know, when they were at WCW, it was something they did quite a bit, you know, for years. So you take all of these factors together, and, yeah, there's definitely a problem.
Interesting. Well, I can tell you this. He was never a problem on the WWE roster. He grew past that, and you know. But it's been an interesting discussion to talk about him, because nobody. I don't think I've interviewed anybody or talked to anybody that actually traveled with him, and so you got an insight that I certainly would never have. I remember, I remember my wife and I running into him and Nancy in Toronto before. WrestleMania 18, was that Toronto 18? I think it was. Is that Hogan and Rock and.
All right.
That 18, I think it was. But 19 was in Seattle. So 18 in Toronto, and then we ran into him in the hotel lobby, and I said, "Where are you going?" He said, "We're going to go eat, find somewhere to go eat." And I said, "Well, that's what we're going to do. You want to go? We found a place, or somebody suggested a place. It was near the hotel, so we went to dinner together the night before WrestleMania." With him and Nancy, and that was no hint of anything. It was just two couples having a pretty benign, you know, laughing and joking, and everything was cool. So he was kind of focused in on what he was going to do the next day, but you know, we still had a pleasant evening. He was a little bit intense, but a lot of guys are intense the night before WrestleMania, you know.
So. Individual, you know, like he you talk about him in the ring, you know, he had two speeds, hard and harder.
Yeah. He's a physical guy. Well, you know, that part of that is because he got broken in a very physical territory in Calgary, and he broke in as a small guy, and he wanted to be Dynamite Kid, and Dynamite Kid was physical, that's what he learned. That's how he played the game. Physically. So good conversation on him, and I'm glad that we got a chance to talk about that. I got a bunch of random things here to talk to you about as we start thinking about wrapping this thing up. You talked about growing as a performer in those tags with Ken Anderson as your partner against Taker and Kane, the Brothers of Destruction. What did you think of Taker's streak ending at WrestleMania 30. What was your impression or your feeling when you heard it or when you saw it or whatever, however you got the news?
I hated that it happened. I think I understood why, because I haven't spoken to Taker in a while, And I'm not going to ask him about it. I'm not going to discuss it with him. But I know on a personal level, because I'm such a huge fan of the Undertaker character and Undertaker the man, my colleague, my peer, my mentor, I wanted to see him be Lou Gehrig, you know. I wanted it to be just that unbeatable record. Leave it. Leave it intact. You know? And if you were going to use it, if you were going to end the streak and use it to make somebody, I understand why they did what they did the way they did it. But, you know, I would have preferred to have left it intact.
2 points on that. I'm with you. I was disappointed. I talked to Shawn Michaels here on a podcast. He said it was decided about 4 hours before the showtime, the day of the show, that the decision was made, and it was Vince's call. And Vince, sat down with Mark, and they talked, and it was finally agreed upon that that was what they would do, is that Undertaker's streak would end, and then it was like 3-4 hours of showtime in New Orleans. I know that guys are involved, the referee, the Lesnar was, a lot of guys are uncomfortable, because it was going on. And, but I can see them with you. It got a lot of people talking, and for the follow up and to get under in WrestleMania and pay per views, it was amazing. I think it was done to enhance the network. I think it was done to drive people to that network, is my take on it. Because you're not going to put the title on Brock or put the break the streak with a part-time guy, and not that Brock doesn't deserve it. I'm not saying that, but he's a part-time guy. So, like you said, if you're going to strategize it long-term and go in with a program and have somebody that can be quote-unquote made, then you do that. But that's not how the game plan was. The game plan was decided 3-4 hours before showtime. So, and Lesnar happened to be up that night. He was the guy. He was working with Taker. So I didn't like it. It reminded me of one of my favorite movies for melancholy reasons, when John Wayne was in his last film called The Shootist and played this aging gunfighter with cancer and he was dying, and the hot gunslingers in the area all wanted to kill him so they could notch their gun, so to speak, and get the reputation. So he sent out word that I'll be there, and he ended up doing the damage, and he got shot in the back by the bartender, which was ironic. Good swerve, good high spot, good booking, but it pissed me off, man, because I thought, well, he'll come out on the other side and be okay, but it didn't happen that way. So sometimes our heroes have got to be humanized, but there'll be never another streak, anything like his streak at WrestleMania ever again. I don't know what could be. Do you? What could somebody do to create that kind of impact at one major event? I can't think of anything.
Me neither. I can't think of anything remotely comparable.
No,
and that kind of a streak. And I don't think that, anything in the business will come that way again, because, man, they don't make them like that anymore.
No. Hey, I mentioned earlier in our conversation, and I've done it try to do it in a positive way, not a mean-spirited way, that, I take shots at WWE's creative from time to time that, I think that the business in general has gotten lazy in a lot of ways and fundamentally got lazy. Everybody's lax on the rules. So consequently, how do you be a heel if there are not any rules to break? I disdain the mounting that second rope and the guys, you got the guy in the corner and you punch down his face 10 times. It's generally more often not always 10. You always win the lottery by buying a 10 ticket. And there's never any DNA, man. There's never a busted lip, black eye, bloody nose.
That's my belief. I say the same thing. Now we know, you know what it looks like when somebody gets punched in the face.
Yeah.
So you're going to sit there with a closed fist, an unprotected fist, and punch somebody in the face 10 times, and there's no lumps, no broken flesh, no nothing.
Yeah,
nah, let's not do
no broken hand. Common sense. It's an expose. So the business itself has kind of gotten lazy with all these lax rules. So if you're a pro wrestling heel today in this world, you have one of the biggest challenges of any heel in any other generation. It's harder to get heat, real heat now, than it's ever been, in my view, ever in the business. Are you somewhat in agreement with that sentiment, or do you look at it differently?
I agree with you wholeheartedly, especially now in a society where, you know, the bad guy, the hero. I mean, you know, Darth Vader was a heel, but he's one of the, you know, the coolest guys ever. Tony Montana was a heel, but hey, everybody loves Tony Montana. You know, everybody, you know, if you're, and especially nowadays, it seems like with pro wrestling, if you're good at being a bad guy, people recognize that, and they say, oh, we love it, he's good at it. You know, Finley, I remember when he came out, Finley is a pure heel, through and through, one of the best heels in the business ever, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But he's so good at being a heel that the fans now recognize, oh, yeah, he's good at being a bad guy, we like that. And, you know, like you said, the rules, there's no way to really piss people off anymore.
It's hard, boy. I'll tell you, it is hard to be that heel. And I think that sometimes the company that takes a step back, and so when you say that, the decision makers always look at you skeptically, because taking a step back means failure or admitting failure. Well, you know, sometimes you got to regroup. Sometimes you want to, you know, you want to repaint the house or, you know, whatever, buy a new set of wheels,
back to leap forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes that one step back gives you that running start to get two steps forward. I think this is me. I'm not asking you to agree with me. I'm just two guys, two friends having a conversation. I want TNA Impact to be successful. There are a lot of guys that work there that I know and I like. I am all for the business in general being thriving and people making money. So they can make a living and buy their groceries and pay their mortgage and all the things we all do.
Absolutely.
So I'm all in. I want, but I believe that until they differentiate themselves from what is perceived WWE-like booking, that they're going to continue to spin their wheels and they're going to continue to hit that same basic number on their on the ratings. I said this a week or so ago that I would love to see TNA start have a cold open, hitting a couple of things that's tonight, but really hit the first main event with a story, a backstory, or why this is happening. And that first main event occur the first rattle out of the box. You come out of the graphic and the cold open right into a ring entrance. I know. I just saw why the match is happening. I know the match is big. And you start the match off, and you give the guys to start that show enough time, meaning maybe working through one break, and if you got somebody that's really good, maybe you get two breaks out of them, get three segments, but you get two segments at least, and you start to show off in a different way than that long promo that everybody's doing. It's in vogue now. Well, we have to start to show off the promo. Why is that? You know, why are we that bad at telling stories now in the business that we have to remind everybody, refresh everybody's memory every first segment of every show every week of where we are? Boy, that disappoints me, and I don't know. And I'm not asking you to indict the company that's paying you. I'm not stupid. I'm not, but I just think that Impact can be more successful if they're more unique and if they expose where their strengths are. And I happen to believe that the team that you're playing on right now has some talent, and I think that there's some people there that can work. And their strengths are bell to bell, not being actors and not being, you know, dramatic or being funny. I think their strengths in that roster overall are bell to bell. So my take is I'd love to see you guys be different than WWE. I know that's not your call, nor am I asking you. I'm not trying to paint you in a corner, but
no, not at all. I don't have any. I think you know me well enough to know that I've never been one to bite my tongue, and especially at this stage in my career. You know, I'm past that. I'm still very new to TNA, and I'm still, you know, figuring out how things work. I've had some discussions with them about, you know, things in terms of creativity, doing some new things, trying some things that are different, and they've been receptive to it. I think that you're right. TNA's biggest strength is in differentiating itself from its competitors.
Sure.
And as far as the talent is concerned, man, I've really, you know, been impressed with the guys I've been able to work with. And there's no fluff on that roster. Those guys can go.
Yeah.
And you know, have a lot of young guys that, you know, if presented in the right way and then set up in the right circumstances, can blossom and become stars in our industry. And I wouldn't disagree with you. I think that's the strength and TNA's path. Their best way is in differentiating themselves from the competitor.
Yeah, it's just counter-programming, you know, and it gives you it's a different presentation of the same genre. So it would make common sense that that's why all reality shows aren't alike, even though they have many of the same properties. You want to create unique and you want to create different as best you can without deviating too far from the quote-unquote reality show format. And I just think that they when I watch it, I see so many things, you know. Of course, that's hindsight. I'm sitting at home. I'm not writing their TV.
Sure.
You know, so it's easier for me to look at. But I just believe that fans still tune in to a wrestling show to watch wrestling. And not to, because, hey, man, I watch this this wrestling show every week. I got a couple of them I watch. And the reason I watch them, I love the dramatic acting. And I love the amazingly undiscovered comedians. It's really cool, man. No, I don't. That ain't even close. So, a dramatic and fired up promo that comes from your heart and not from your memory of a script from someone pretending they're you while they're typing on their little computer and then giving you, okay, here's your script. I don't buy that. You guys in the wrestling business have always been, the great ones have been talented enough. You give them your direction, give them their bullet points, and now go sick them. Go put your touches to it. Go be yourself. And then the same thing with comedy. I've seen some funny-ass stuff on wrestling over the years that was not even intended to be funny. But, boy, when you write it, now you guys got that little spud guy. He's a funny guy. He's a colorful look. He's like Santino in WWE. You know, Santino's a funny guy. He's natural. He's got natural timing.
Natural timing, exactly.
Yeah.
Natural timing.
Yeah. So if you got that, and if I was, and I wouldn't, I'd keep Santino in that role. He'll always be employed because he's good at what he does. But there's a few guys that have that comedic timing. So I think that TNA, I hope that they can continue to explore new ideas, new concepts. I think the fact that they're introducing some new talents is good. Every territory I ever worked in, or every promotion I ever worked for, every company I ever worked for, always benefited by introducing new talent. Pat Patterson says that the talents get stale, and if we bring in somebody that's still, it's not any better than the talent we got rid of, at least they're new. And, you know,
right.
Pat would say they may be a piece of crap, but if they're a new piece of crap.
So new crap. Yeah.
You know, it's a different ball. You know, it's a different wrapper on the candy. So I think that's – I'm told that they're going to introduce – they're bringing in some new talents. And I like the little the thing you guys got going. Somebody said, well, is MVP's group, his faction, are they copying Evolution? I said, no. You think Evolution is the first faction in pro wrestling? Are you kidding me? I mean, same thing with I wonder who they said that about when the Freebirds came along years ago. Who are they copying? Well, there's somebody that had a group, you know, whether you had two or three guys and a manager and whatever. I don't know who, you know, it's just crazy. Everything is basically the same. It's just we have an opportunity to execute it differently and better.
It seems nowadays, you know, because of social media, we have this new wave of critics. You know, well, once upon a time, those same people just decided, hey, man, I'm going to enjoy the show. And, okay, yeah, maybe you have your criticisms here and there. For the most part, you enjoyed the show. But now everybody can criticize. You know, you can go to your, you know, Facebook or your Twitter or whatever, and now you have direct access to these people so you can tell them how you feel.
Yeah.
But you and I don't know, because you've seen it time and again, where somebody will tell you, oh, JR, you suck. That person will climb over three or four people to get to you if they meet you in person and take a picture with you.
Yeah.
So, you know, when it comes to people talking about we're copying Evolution, it seems like, you know, those people are just looking for something to gripe about.
Yeah, are you? They want to engage. They want to see if you're going to respond to it. That's all it is.
Ridiculous, yeah. Are we a nation of domination 2.0? So from now on, every time three guys who happen to be of color, you put them together, is that the yardstick? Is it automatically, if you put some black guys together, this is another nation of domination?
Mm-hmm.
Three guys that have like interests. And we decided we were going to align ourselves. So why does this other stuff have to come on? So I dismiss it for what it is, for what it's evolved, what it's become, you know?
Yeah.
I dismiss most of that. At the end of the day, I love pro wrestling. And I remember as a kid when I watched it, I didn't care about the brand. What I cared about was the action.
Yep.
That's what, you know, I remember that this particular, and as a kid, now that I'm older and I'm in the profession, I remember as a kid, I didn't even differentiate World Class from AWA. I didn't even get into the names. I just remembered the guys that I liked. So this wrestling, I know this wrestling has Kerry Von Erich. You know, I like Kerry Von Erich. Oh, this wrestling has Mr. Wrestling number 2. I like him. You know, the brand didn't matter to me. I just remember the action that I saw and the guys that I saw. That's what drew me to it. So even now today, it seems like because of WWE's market share, they've become so powerful as a brand. You have lots of people that are completely unaware that wrestling exists in Japan and that wrestling exists in Mexico. And people in those places have wrestling that they watch and don't necessarily watch American wrestling. So, you know, I don't worry about those people. I love wrestling fans, people who sit down and say, hey, this is great wrestling. I want to watch this match. You know? And we as professional wrestlers have a duty, no matter what the creative department has going on, we got to get out there in the ring at the end of the day and do the best to put on the matches that people want to keep watching.
Yeah, you got to execute, man. It's up to you. It's out of creative's hands once the bell rings. And, you know, I think that the guys, depending on the leadership of any organization and taking that step back just for fundamental sake, selling better, selling more, selling at different levels. When a talent sells, it gives the announcer time to tell a better story. It's just spot after spot. You know, I went to a show up in Toronto not too long ago with I had a show up there, and I went to the Ring of Honor New Japan show. And had fun. I enjoyed it. And I sat in the stands and watched it. But they put me in a hockey rink, so I think it was in a penalty box, appropriately enough. But I enjoyed watching it as a fan, but I'm thinking, golly, man, if that guy would just not have gotten up and sold his back a little bit longer, then the announcers could have really – give me a reason to care why that guy was hurting so bad, and to explain what happened and to what he's suffering from and what this means to the match and all these type things. But they're right back up, man. And they're doing a high spot series again. Boom, 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 boom. And it was amazing. Just, and then you say that to people, and then the young fans look at you like, well, you're too old to understand that we like the action, but you're missing the psychology. You're missing the feel for what's going on. You just want to see bumps. You just want to see the Flying Walendas do their thing and then somebody lose by a small package.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Pat Patterson told me once, and actually he told a room full of us, he was talking to us about, you know, the art of selling. And he said the best match is between two guys who are trying to outsell each other.
Yep.
And I never forgot that. You know, and I always try to take pride in selling. You know, I remember watching a match many, many years ago, and I remember when, and it's something I kept with me to this day. I've never forgotten. I still do it. I remember watching when he went to shoot, his arm was being worked on the whole time, and when he went to shoot the guy off, he shook out his arm, showing that it still hurt.
Yeah.
You know, with the clothesline. And you know, to this day, if, you know, someone's working my arm when I go through the comeback, before I would do my balling elbow, I would always, you know, sell that left arm, like, you know, and do a half-assed version of the elbow because my arm was too hurt.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that's important. You know, I think you can't throw that away. And now, with the popularity of MMA, professional wrestling was the original MMA.
Yep.
And now with MMA and its popularity, you know, okay, you got to, I think, you know, the two lanes are different, but with certain things have to evolve. And like you were talking about the 10 punches in the corner. Okay, we see what it looks like when a guy gets punched in the face with 4 ounce gloves. You know, that's kind of exposing the business a little bit. So don't punch a guy right in the forehead 5-10 times with a, you know, bare fist, because I, you know.
Yeah, well, if you can't knock a guy out in 10 shots, you don't even punching anybody.
But then the flip side of that is there are those people who go, yeah, I know. But at the same time, I know you can't whip a guy into the rope and he's going to bounce back into your drop kick. You know, but I like that. I like the 10 punches in the corner. I like the double noggin knocker. I like the camp of it. I enjoy it. You know, so what do you say to that person?
Well, I think you say, well, good. I'm glad you found something you enjoy. If it doesn't bother you, but I just think that there are subtle little things that the boys can do that makes it easier on them, extends their shelf life, makes the matches more believable, more realistic, and lets me as a fan get lost in the process, and where I'm not overthinking or worried about what I'm going to say on Twitter because I know your Twitter handle, you know,
right.
You know what I mean? I'd rather just enjoy the process. And if you find something you enjoy, then consume it. What do you think you're going to do when your bumping days are over?
You know, it's interesting you asked that. I just came back from Los Angeles where I had some pitch meetings for a TV show that I developed with Eli Franco from Lionsgate TV. And those meetings went very, very well, very receptive. And I actually have another idea for a television show that I'm talking to a different production company about. So I may still end up, somewhere in the production side of TV. It seems like that's where I'm kind of heading. But at the end of the day, I'd like to just buy a bar and disappear somewhere and just sit at the end of the bar, drink scotch, and call it a life.
There you go, man. Here's what I believe. I believe at the end of the day, whatever you choose is going to be the path, and it's going to be one that you're going to find success, because if what you have endured after 9.5 years in prison, after getting into a good old boy business called pro wrestling as a black man, if all these things haven't put you down for the count, then nothing will. So I believe that whatever you do is going to be successful, and I think that you've got a great story to tell, and I believe that there's a place for you in the private sector or the public sector to tell your story, because I do believe it's that compelling. And, you know, whether that's a big screen or the small screen or a lecture hall or wherever it may be or all of the above.
Funny you mentioned that's actually something that I'm, as of right now, I'm actually looking into, trying to expand into some motivational speaking and whatnot. We're on the same page.
I feel it, man. I just think you got a great story. Listen, I really appreciate you being with me tonight, and I know the fans that you told. You know, we've got more. You know, talking about your life and how the teenage years was unbelievable, but you never let the dream of where you wanted to go, where you wanted to be, end. You kept dreaming. And, boy, when people stop dreaming, they start dying. You just can't do it. You can't let yourself get into a helpless situation mentally, because all you're doing is facilitating the whole damn thing to become a reality. And that's just the wrong thing to do unless you're just a psychopath and you want to just be miserable and pissed off all the time. So I have so much admiration for what you've done and what you've gone through and how you come out, as I said earlier, on the other side, a whole man and a good man, and I think you're going to be fine. So I appreciate you taking the time to be on the show, and I hope to see you again somewhere down the road, someplace, sometime.
I'm absolutely certain we'll see each other somewhere down the road. I want to tell you it was an honor for me to be on your podcast. I know how popular it is. I always see it in the number one slot, so that was real cool. And it was good having a chance to just get sit and talk with you, because unfortunately we never got too many opportunities
No.
in our the times that our careers overlapped to sit and shoot the breeze once or twice over a beer here and there. But I enjoyed the conversation and greeted you.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate it, and I will be talking to you soon, hopefully.
You take care. Look after yourself.
Okay, man. Thanks.